Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Earnings season, so that means a healthy dose of earnings today, but we spread it out through multiple sectors for you. We're also going to talk about a managerial move. We're going to jump into the auto parts category, this time not with AutoZone, but one of their competitors, and department stores as Kohl's establishes themselves as perhaps the strongest department store in 2018 operationally. Our interview guest is Imbal Levy, CEO of WebPals. She'll discuss the big holiday that most U.S. retailers tend to miss out on. Find out more about that if you stick around to the interview segment. As always, like us, rate us wherever you listen to us. You can check us out on Twitter and Instagram as well at Retail Podcast. We start today's podcast content with the off-price sector as TJX beats on earnings once again, underscoring the strength of this retail area. Large assortment of apparel and home goods for TJX has helped the retailer in recent years, and they've sought to attract more customers. Along with more robust inventory of off-priced but oftentimes brand-named items, they've opened a slew of new stores over the last 2 years, and they've cleaned up existing ones as well with a refurbishing program. Now, Leighton and I have both visited stores within the last year that have been open for more than 10 years. The difference is obvious. It no longer looks like someone's garage sale. The stores are cleaner, still not the cleanest retail stores you'll ever find, but the rehab is very obvious. TJ Maxx's business model had once been the punchline, in fact, of some well-known comedians complaining about finding toys mixed in with designer shoes. Those days, we can't say they're over for sure, certainly, as some locations will vary, but those days, they're fighting to make those days a thing of the past. Thanks to savvy leadership and a bullish outlook on brick-and-mortar off-price offerings, the company has been a market beater for the last few years, and they look to stay on point in 2018 with this excellent earnings call.
Their stores, if you go in them, are certainly cleaner. It's a much cleaner look, and if you look around, the merchandise is segmented appropriately. Certainly a change from about 10 or 12 years ago if you went into an individual location. You see that for this quarter, the company performed well in nearly every conceivable way, which represented their fiscal 2019 first quarter results. Both the company and analysts were impressed with same-store sales, which were good, but not our only focal point for this particular earnings release. Their 3% same-store sales comps came in above company guidance, above 20% from those Wall Street estimates as well. Their Marmaxx division, which holds the domestic sales figures from TJ Maxx, but not their subsidiaries, Home Goods or Sierra Trading, was up 4%. Home Goods saw comps of around 2%, and international stores were positive, but they were mixed depending on what market you look at. Revenue for the company topped $8.7 billion, which represented a 12% increase over last year's first quarter and 2.5% above average forecast within that metric. So, what impressed us the most? If those figures didn't impress us that much, you have to look and see that net income figure, which beat on estimates from analysts, but you see the uptake in earnings per share full year guidance was also in play. TJ Maxx's net income skyrocketed 33.6% to $716.4 million, or around $1.13 per diluted share in the quarter that ended on May 5th from a year earlier. GAAP diluted earnings per share hit $1.13 compared with the 82 cents in the prior year. This is a massive adjustment. You see that the company has built-in efficiencies, and also you have to factor in the tax return. They're not paying as much in terms of total taxes, as that corporate tax rate has gone down. Not just the absolute amount of net income, but also the net margins for the company they've been able to sustain as of late is really impressive to us, as we see that dividing the net income this quarter by their earnings beat brings to light a net margin of around 8.3%. Last year, the company's net margin for the first quarter was 6.8%, signifying that the company has built out efficiencies and they're working to make those newly opened stores more profitable in a much quicker way. Even though they do not do more in sales than their competitor in Ross, they are now looking to meet Ross's average net margin, which sits around 9% historically. And speaking of those margins, Trent, their cost of goods sold was not the primary factor in helping the bottom line, as that line item was nearly 10 basis points higher versus last year. Selling, general, and administrative expenses, however, were 17.8% of sales, an improvement over last year's 18.1% level. The all-important product assortment and, at least, our perception of fuller shelves look to play a bigger role in the higher inventory that was represented on their balance sheet, to the tune of $600 million more in product inventory. Inventory per store was up 6%. A level that management cited as suitable for their strategic vision. We wouldn't be surprised to see this slightly increase going forward, but it's probably at a good level currently. If you look back on a historical basis, it was actually down this time last year. So they're trying to find the right position for their strategic vision. And I think the current inventory levels, if you go into a store, they have adequate inventory on their shelves. It's not too cluttered. It's not too empty. They are finding a perfect niche. And despite this, the company still has higher levels of cash on hand. That cash hoarding and product inventory going up did not stop management and the board from relinquishing around $600 million to shareholders in their first quarter via buybacks and dividends. The dividend, by the way, was increased 25% from the first quarter. And this begs the question, why are you and I not long-term shareholders again, Trent?
Not sure of that. I held TJX for a short time, a little bit 2 years ago, when they were one of the standouts in a retail industry that was battered a little bit during 2016, but still some bright spots sold off since then. We discussed the high-performing nature of these financial results, particularly inventory going up, which sometimes is a bad thing. In this case, it's a good thing. They felt inventory levels a little bit low after last year's holiday season, or after the holiday season from 2016 going into 2017. They've done some corrective actions, even with an increased store count this year, even at the cost of higher priced inventory. So let's dig a little bit more into their conference call input. Ernie Herrman, the president and CEO, started off the call by almost sounding surprised in a good way, though. Is the great news for TJ Maxx this latest quarter seemed to be that traffic was actually the primary driver for all of the healthy comps rather than ticket size. This at a time when you'd think no one was going to physical stores simply because of the way it's covered in most media outlets. Instead, their physical store traffic is up. Not only robust traffic levels, but this was their 15th consecutive quarter of positive traffic comps at the Marmaxx division, which, as Leighton talked about, includes both TJ Maxx and Marshall's. Leadership spoke of being able to persevere through any economic condition. And what's nice here is that their numbers and track record certainly back up the rhetoric. I mentioned 2016 a few moments ago. In 2016, a lot of people very bearish on retail as a whole, but during that year, TJ Maxx, just like their cousins in Ross, a separate company, but similar segment, they were able to grow. And this strong-mindedness seems to give the confidence to continue to grow domestically, but also globally, even when the economy is going well and even when there's a lot of discretionary income floating around. So you might ask, are there any downsides here for TJX? Well, despite what you may hear about those sticky wage reports from the big macro, retailers and food service providers are consistently sounding off about higher overall wages. Granted, many have countered that with what they hope to be more efficient sales-based scheduling, which we've talked about with interview guests on the podcast in the past. Also, maintaining a specific ratio of part-time to full-time employees. You don't want to say gaming the system, but in efforts to avoid certain types of taxes or certain types of insurance, just like we talked about last week with regards to Seattle tax reform as an example. For TJ Maxx, the increase in wages impacted their earnings per share growth this last quarter by about 2%. So not a ton, but it did have a slight impact. We mentioned merchandise margin declining as far as cost of goods sold, but supply chain costs were up in general. And while they didn't mention the word fuel on the call, we can assume, of course, that that played a part. Their HomeSense stores, only amounts to a handful of stores, in fact, in their chain, experienced some heavy markdowns due to some slow-moving inventory. And one of the other aspects that might have been a little bit more negative is the significant wage pressures in Canada, seemingly more so than in the United States. A challenging retail landscape in Europe also may hinder their midterm future growth plans there. All in all, though, a lot to like on this earnings call, even though those slight negatives that we've mentioned might keep the stock from just exploding upward. This is a company that's been very consistent in their message to consumers. They've been very consistent in their internal goals. And what's more is when you look at their internal goals from 3, 4, 5 years ago, they've been able to meet these. It's one of the reasons why you see such great earnings calls like this.
It's been nice to see that management has really backed up all of the plans they've been talking about over the past few quarters. In the end, they feel like wherever they set up shop, either it's here domestically or internationally, they will be at the forefront in the consumer's mind in terms of the value proposition and in terms of fashion. And what's interesting, Trent, is you were reading a lot of the media releases after this earnings report saying all of the positive things, talking about they carry Michael Kors and other elite brands. Not a lot of those elite brands are found in the stores, but very solid brands nonetheless. You see a lot of Nike, you see a lot of fashionable footwear. So I think they really are at the forefront in terms of the value and just the consistent messaging to the consumer that you can buy something here at 30 to 40% off where you may be able to buy it at a full price retailer. We believe this extends into home goods as well and even some other smaller niche categories that they carry that they may struggle with from time to time, like Trent had mentioned, with their HomeSense stores. But overall, this is exactly the focus and the confidence they need to grow. And really, if you look at their store footprint, making a strong case for market share gains throughout the rest of the calendar year 2018 does not seem too far-fetched. And speaking of store count, they added 71 stores globally in the first quarter alone, now with 4,141 stores in all of their countries that they do business in. Over 73% of their overall store count are still housed in the United States. However, that number is ticking downward as they focus into their Europe expansion. You see shares of TJ Maxx, ticker TJX, rose over 3% in trading on Tuesday. All-time highs of around $87 a share now, over 17% from 1 year ago levels. The dividend yield is now 1.8%. There, if you're an institutional shareholder, you would like to see that number tick up, but overall, you're getting and reaping those capital gains that the company has been providing. We'll move on to a quick pre-interview story all over the news this week. Is Marvin Ellison, it was announced that he is going back to the home improvement space by taking the CEO spot there at Lowe's. This announcement came on Tuesday, just prior to their Wednesday earnings call. We'll focus on a number of things here, but first, you have to see that Marvin Ellison has had leadership roles at Home Depot, so this is automatically a win for Lowe's, which has performed well, but not nearly as well as their larger competitor in Home Depot. Ellison will look to officially step down at JCPenney on June 1st, as JCPenney will put in place, and I quote, a search party to find another CEO sooner than later. What is striking about this announcement is that it comes just days after JCPenney's first quarter woes, a quarter that we spoke of on this very podcast, one that was very disappointing in terms of their long-term growth potential. A lot of those initiatives that Marvin Ellison had talked about are working, but they're not working to the extent that you would hope they would if you were a shareholder. One in which could have been worse, again, a quarter that wasn't horrible, but showed little traction for those initiatives. And those initiatives, like bringing toys and appliances to their stores, building out Sephora even more so, 4 to 5 quarters now, they've been talking about these initiatives, Trent. So a little worrisome if you're a short or a long-term shareholder there. Shares right now are near an all-time low. With Lowe's, many are hoping that this takes Ellison's best retail attributes to the test. Analysts from CNBC expect him to do much better in the home improvement sector, really moving away from clothing, an area that he wasn't too familiarized with given his track record and his retail history.
Yeah, so getting back into the hard goods sector, Marvin Ellison, there's a lot of hope there from shareholders as the shares did go up. But what is most head-scratching was his long-term tone on the call with JCPenney. He has, or at least the company would make it seem, has played an integral part in getting new key executives on board, one being a new CFO appointment last summer. Let's take a look at his Home Depot history as kind of a backdrop to this new role with Lowe's. In all, he was with Home Depot for a pretty significant amount of time. He was an executive from 2002 to 2014 and served in various different roles there. Before coming to Home Depot, he worked at loss prevention at Target and then moved up the ranks. Target was actually one of his first jobs, he said, making only $4 per hour. Stayed there for nearly a dozen years, according to Forbes. Now, at Home Depot, he made his way up to be in charge of the U.S. division. He was passed over for the CEO spot, and many pointed to a potential lack of identifying the right products and trending categories to go big on at Home Depot. Now, stop me if that seems familiar, but it also seems familiar to a lot of the criticisms he faced while at JCPenney over the last few years. Now, despite this, the board at Home Depot felt confident he would eventually be pulled away from Home Depot for a more promising role, and sure enough, not soon after, he was made an offer from JCPenney. After they went through a disastrous rebranding and merchandising overhaul that you'll remember from the earlier part of this decade, tanked the company. In his first few months at JCPenney, proved to be a success. He brought back different brands, pulled the trigger on valuable resets in footwear and men's categories. Ellison made multiple rounds during his tenure at JCPenney. He visited over 100 stores. He set up town hall-like meetings so he could meet with both employees and customers. But one big issue that was addressed under his watch was proper ordering quantities for big events or promotional pushes. JCPenney, prior to Ellison's tenure, made clear errors when estimating the demand for certain items, leaving a lot of money on the table. And now it seems like the opposite may be happening, where the company buys too much of something only to have to mark it down over the next couple of quarters. And one of the interesting things here, Leighton, about this deal is we spent a lot of Tuesday looking over some of the hot takes that were out there regarding this, and they mentioned, several pundits did, including Jim Cramer, that potentially it was the JCPenney perhaps couldn't be turned around if Marvin Ellison couldn't get the job done. But there's this idea there that you have your turnaround CEO and then the CEO that kind of gets your business over the hump. And maybe Marvin Ellison was a good fit in 2014, but as we've seen over the last couple of quarters, it seems as though like JCPenney has kind of gotten ADHD with some of these new initiatives, and they don't really know necessarily what to focus on. They've had difficulties now with inventory management, and some of the same difficulties are cropping up that Ellison took over when he took the job originally at JCPenney. So perhaps it's not so much that JCPenney can't be rehabilitated, because I think we would both agree they're in far better position today than they are 4 years ago, but perhaps they need someone that maybe is a little bit more familiar with the overall segment, or maybe comes in with a laser-sharp focus on improving a few categories in particular to kind of get JCPenney over that hump. So I'll be anxious to see what JCPenney does going forward. I don't think they're a brand that cannot be rehabilitated. I think they're a brand that Ellison has made more healthy. And I think this will also help out Lowe's. As we move forward here, Lowe's is going to pull Ellison away from JCPenney, looking to capture almost 30 years of experience. And there were a lot of people that really liked this deal, particularly for Lowe's.
This is really going to be a test for Lowe's, as they've sort of had some activist pressure as of late. And you could see just representative in their stock price and their sales and their profits. And you compare that to Home Depot. Like I said, while they've been doing fairly well, they could be doing a lot better. But you have to question putting Ellison in place where, you know, they're on a good trajectory, but the improvement plans put in place for JCPenney, they haven't yet bared fruit. I think overall, you're looking at a company that is just borderline profitable, but JCPenney still has a lot of work to go. And you can look at the statements by JCPenney spokespeople. They told CNBC earlier this week that they were just informed by Ellison leaving a couple of days ago, and they were not made aware of this report prior to earnings. They currently now have four executives filling in to run the day-to-day operations for the company, and they're looking for both internal and external candidates to fill the vacancy that's going to be left by Ellison on June 1st. This is going to definitely hurt the company morale with JCPenney, especially if the rest of the executive team truly had no inkling whatsoever that Ellison would be moving on just within days. He'll be looking to take over, as you mentioned, Trent, as CEO of Lowe's on July 2nd, replacing the current Lowe's CEO, Robert Nyblock, who is retiring. JCPenney shares are down around 6% on the news. Lowe's shares are up around 3% on the news, or they were earlier in the week. JCPenney shares falling really compounds the drop-off that they felt during last week's earnings call. So a 1-2 punch there if you're a shareholder not feeling too good. Lowe's shares were down from all-time highs of around $107 in January to about $85 on Tuesday before market close. JCPenney closed to around a 35-year low on Tuesday of this week to around $2.35 a share, where they stayed throughout trading on Wednesday. And speaking of Lowe's stock and what it's going to mean, at least for the company in the short term, we turn to the recent earnings release that happened earlier on Wednesday. The numbers were not as robust as the increase in the stock price would have suggested. Shares initially went up around 9% as the market opened and maintained throughout Wednesday's trading. For the quarter, Lowe's had revenue of around $15.5 billion, just slightly above the consensus estimates. However, comparable store sales just increased 0.6%, which is fairly dismal in the home improvement category, a category that has been beating other retail categories, particularly department stores and in the mall segment. A significant margin behind Home Depot's 3.9% increase in same-store sales from their most recent quarter. It is becoming increasingly clear that Home Depot is running away in this particular race. While Lowe's has been firmly in second place over the last 2 years, their numbers in comparison to their larger competitor are slipping a little bit further. Selling, general, and administrative expenses were up as a percentage of sales, and inventory costs increased 7.8%. So while Lowe's is in far better shape than, say, JCPenney, Ellison still has some work to do on this front.
And they also missed analyst expectations by 8 cents per share with adjusted earnings per share of $1.19. Now, this resulted in a pre-market drop of the share price by 2.6% before shares exploded upward by over 10% during Wednesday's trading. The primary driver of the shares being up is the fact that activist investor Bill Ackman disclosed that his hedge fund Pershing Square had acquired around $1 billion in shares. He disclosed this at a conference where he also gave a nod to the CEO appointment of Marvin Ellison. Ackman now has a far from perfect track record, especially when it comes to retail, but both with his long positions and his shorts. He arguably is the one who expedited JCPenney's fall in the first place back with the appointment of Ron Johnson. And under Ron Johnson, JCPenney, I think it would be fair to say, became a raving dumpster fire several years ago. And a lot of people blamed Ackman for that. Perhaps he's making sure JCPenney suffers, as he may have had a hand in Ellison suddenly leaving his perch there. Ellison has a close relationship with another activist investor who had a history with Home Depot and is an ally, by the way, with Ackman. Despite having notable losses, Ackman still has quite a following. You still read articles about him all the time on any of the financial outlets, and a following that usually will invest where he does, as well as exit when Pershing Square does. As a result, shares, as you would imagine, are popular at the moment, hovering around $94 a piece. Coming up, we'll be joined by Imbal Levy. She's the CEO of WebPals. She'll discuss the sales boost surrounding a holiday we're right in the middle of, but that so many U.S. retailers overlook. For retailers in the U.S., much is made out of retail holidays such as Black Friday, Cyber Monday, or even Prime Day. But for retailers with an international presence, this time of year is equally as important. Why is that? Well, it's the observance of Ramadan, which began back on May 15th. Here to help us unpack this trend is Imbal Levy. She is the CEO of WebPals Group, a fast-growing performance marketing company specializing in online and mobile traffic. Imbal, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, I think, especially for our U.S. listeners that are out there, some people might be familiar with just a few of the Ramadan traditions, such as the fasting from sunrise to sunset. But why is this month so crucial to e-commerce or international retailers?
So, very good question. So, actually, during this month, on the one hand, people spend much more time at home with the family, have more, I would say, kind of home and family time. And on the other hand, they want to get ready for the festive during Ramadan. So that makes them buy all sorts of new clothing and so on. So that obviously drives the retail in general. And when you look at it from our perspective in terms of mobile activity, that definitely drives both e-commerce and, by the way, also travel. Because people would travel to meet with their family together for the holiday. So I think in that sense, travel and shop online holiday, as it is also in retail. Obviously, you know, in London, for instance, the Ramadan rush to Harrods is something that's well known for years. I would say that as retail goes more and more online and mobile, we will also see the e-commerce expand and grows much more during this period.
Now, your company takes in, of course, a lot of data, and that's a lot about where your background is, certainly is in data analysis, that type of thing. It's not just the period during Ramadan. I read a lot regarding sales before Ramadan, making sure people's wardrobe is on point for Ramadan or even Eid at the end of Ramadan. How much traffic takes place, whether it's mobile or otherwise, before versus during Ramadan?
So I would say that, first of all, we see two major peaks, one of which is actually before Ramadan, something like 3 weeks before the Ramadan, where people start to get ready for the holiday. And the second peak would be the third week of Ramadan, just before the festive. We would see, you know, it depends on the week, but during the peaks, we could see up to 200% increase in terms of sales, which is obviously very significant. By the way, in terms of the timing, we would see most of it concentrated, obviously, at night, given the nature of the holiday. So we would see something like 200% increase in the transactions actually at night, anywhere between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m., which is kind of rare, obviously, in other circumstances.
You mentioned the night traffic, and that's what I'd like to get into next. I know a lot of brick-and-mortar retailers, like in the United Arab Emirates, for example, will adjust hours. They'll stay open later, at least on the brick and mortar front. But in terms of that digital traffic, how can retailers better adjust to maybe taking on more traffic during those non-peak times where ordinarily in the other 11 months of the year, 11 months worth of time in the year, you don't expect traffic during those hours?
Yes, so exactly as you say, what happens is the advertisers should know that they should be kind of tuning their traffic buying to very specific hours. So they would try, you know, to offer the relevant product to the potential customers during Ramadan on very specific hours, which would be the later hours of the day, because, you know, for instance, when I'm home with the family at night and my mobile is at the palm of my hand, that would be a natural time. If I'm now being shown some ad about some dress or some piece of clothing, then it's probably much more imminent for me to make this purchase.
Now, your firm, WebPals, obviously generates a ton of data just through the course of your guys' day-to-day operation. What are some of the more interesting trends, other than maybe nighttime shopping, but some of the outside or external trends that you've seen surrounding Ramadan?
So first of all, if I look, for instance, at 2017, we saw something like 200% increase in traffic during the Ramadan time in general, which is obviously very significant. If you look at the conversion, so we saw an uplift of over 25% in conversion, which shows that people are much more prone to make the purchase. So given that you give them the very relevant offer with the right creative, that would probably lead to higher probability of actually making the purchase. We actually have our own forecast also towards 2018. So what we predict is something around at least 220% increase in traffic during Ramadan during this year, and at least as high as a 30% increase in conversion during this period. So we definitely think that this is a very interesting period for mobile advertisers.
Talk about the increase in conversion. A lot of people, that's what they're focused on right now, especially in terms of mobile shopping. But how can retailers kind of make that jump and make sure that, you know, if someone was looking at a product before Ramadan, maybe they didn't buy it, maybe it's still hanging out in their shopping cart, that they come back to convert that sale during Ramadan?
That's a great question, because this is exactly knowing how to actually utilize and leverage your data. Because if you know that someone was interested in some kind of product, then maybe during Ramadan is a good time to try and offer that and offer it, obviously, in the relevant time of day as well, maybe during the peak week or weeks during that period. So actually, the more you learn about your customers pre-Ramadan, you will be able to probably use or leverage that data to be able to offer the right product, read the right message, you know, also maybe related to the holiday during the very relevant time, and that would probably lead to the highest conversion possible.
Now, I don't want to belabor the point, but again, your company, what you are very good at is sending traffic and making sure the traffic is correct and proper, what you're sending to e-commerce retailers. And there's a lot of e-commerce retailers, particularly those in the U.S., that seem to overlook this month-long period, despite the fact that they do ship to a lot of countries where a high percentage of the population does celebrate Ramadan. So what can retailers that maybe don't have a focus on this holiday be doing to drive some of this traffic during the time?
So I would say, A, learn your audience. Understand exactly which type of products are relevant to that specific period. Understand the very relevant days within that period in order to be able to target this audience. Use the tech, you know, use the tech to be able to segment the relevant target audience and offer them the very relevant creative, the very relevant offer based on data of people that are similar to them. You know, for us, for instance, we use our own technology that is able to create all sorts of sub-segments, understand their different characteristics. According to that, not only do we know which type of product we want to offer them, but also which type of creative that we create here on our own using our in-house studio. And, you know, using this 360-degree marketing approach, eventually, I believe, leads to performance. So that this is exactly what I would advise the retailers to do using their own products.
Imbal Lavi, the CEO of WebPals, talking about Ramadan shopping trends. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thank you very much.
Well, we thank Inbal for joining us, and we move on with the news section of our podcast. We jump into the auto parts sector as Advance Auto Parts continues a two-year-long slide with earnings released on Tuesday. We would say we're disappointed, but they did beat bottom-line estimates by analysts. We've been reasonably bullish with auto parts, despite some up-and-down earnings calls from the four major auto parts retailers. However, Advance Auto Parts is firmly behind AutoZone, who we talked about during last earnings season and is probably our favorite for growth in this sector. They're also behind O'Reilly's Auto Parts in terms of both development, growth, and new stores. Now, this earnings call continues a more often than not trend of shrinking sales at Advance, with declines in both top-line revenue overall and same-store sales. Now, if there's any positive news, it's probably that the revenue losses were not as great in this year's first quarter as last year's. Despite some cold weather headwinds this year, weather can be both good and bad for the auto parts sector, as we've seen, but it always seems to be blamed for poor quarterly showings. Just like the fashion segment, cold weather can hinder motivation, of course, for preventative work. But on the opposite side of the coin, it can increase sales for things like de-icer and antifreeze. Now, auto parts sales operations will tell you that they don't make as much on de-icer, antifreeze, and rock salt as they would for preventative work or any other car work that is most likely done in warm weather, including people doing their own oil changes. Now, in terms of exactly where Advance Auto Parts sits in terms of size, I mentioned they're the third largest, at least in the U.S. They have a $9 billion market cap versus O'Reilly's $21 billion and AutoZone's $16.5 billion. Leighton, time to get to the results. And the results, again, saw less in overall revenue.
$20 million less in revenue did come in for Advance Auto Parts during their first quarter. Sales totaled $2.87 billion, representing a $40 million miss versus those Wall Street expectations. Comps were down 0.8%, which was a deeper cut than the comparable overall revenue decline that we saw. They cited a great start to the quarter. In fact, they said on the call 11 weeks of positive sales. However, that was followed by 5 weeks of lagging spring season sales because of that cold weather. Not a lot of people headed to their stores, putting off maybe some of those maintenance items that Trent had noted. Affected most in terms of their geographical districts were the Northeast and North Central markets. Because of the toll that the winter weather took on cars, they alluded to seeing sales growth in the second quarter. So comps in the second quarter maybe are going to be positive, and that should be noteworthy, a call that we're certainly looking forward to. Adjusted earnings per share this quarter of around $2.10. That beat the Zacks consensus estimate of $1.98 per share. This was indicative of 31% year-over-year growth on the earnings per share side. Operating income margin increased to 7.8%, 71 basis points compared to the prior year period. And the company has been running a bit more efficiently, something they've talked about for quite some time now, really trying to streamline the back-end operation. And you see the management's focus has been paying off as they've been maintaining robust quarterly cash flow. This quarter ended with $119 million in free cash. And Trent, I would love a piece of that money if I could have it. But this was much better in terms of the cash position versus this time last year. Can we spot any product trends? We talk about a lot of sales coming in for the retailer, maybe not making the same store sales marks, but you look at the items that sold and it's pretty consistent with prior quarters. Details of the best-selling categories were a bit spotty from the call, but CEO Tom Greco did mention a few highlights that should help us compare sales between them and their competitors. Sales increases were seen in batteries, lighting, and wiper blades. Car wash chemicals, or as what management called appearance chemicals, were down, however, for the quarter. Again, they blamed winter weather because when the weather's not that nice, people don't want to get out and wash their cars. But then also, they blamed heavy rains for this. If it's raining outside, why would you wash your car with more water? It just does not make sense. And because of that, it hurts sales in that particular category. Again, they are bullish on these sales of cleaning supplies and everything else really popping up for the second quarter. They are not shying away from saying that they expect a great second quarter for the company's sales. We should, however, take this with a grain of salt as they have a history of being overly optimistic in the past and then not seeing the results to back it up. So again, the second quarter is going to be one that we have our eye on. As a result of all of the different variables that affect the car care industry, they think that they can reasonably predict what to buy and when to buy it. So from the supply chain perspective, from the distribution perspective, they really see an increase in market share going forward for the rest of this calendar year. The topic of market share, in our opinion, while important, is something that they should maybe stop focusing on the call so much. Maintaining customer value and adequately predicting trends should be the number one priority for management, and then market share gains will come from that. And this is interesting because this is exactly what Jeff Bezos talks about. Whenever we talk about Amazon, we talk about how they consistently have the message of being customer focused. And with this earnings call, that's not necessarily all about the customer. They do, like we will be talking about in a bit, have some customer initiatives going forward. But market share overall should come from executing at a high level and making your customers pleased and making them committed to your company. Being in the number three spot in the United States in their sector, it would be wise for them to really keep their eye off of their competition and more on what you can do to stay strong with your core fundamentals. That said, they think that they do have some buying efficiency and some budget awareness that they have that should be impactful for the rest of the year. They should be able to keep prices low and keep more of a value offering, which we think is extremely important for this company. Even though replacement parts are usually sought after within a time-sensitive window, for instance, if your alternator goes out, you need to get it immediately. It is not hard for customers to price out those needed items before making the trip to one of these types of stores. Walmart, for one, they don't carry a lot of big ticket items like alternators, but they certainly do compete on price and pretty well on price, in our opinion, for non-specialty items like batteries, oil, filters, and wiper blades. So you have to keep your eye on all of your competition, and not only Walmart, but O'Reilly and AutoZone have the benefit of larger economies of scale, and AutoZone now is beginning to see an edge with time to store for their products.
Part of that is because of their robust distribution initiatives, and we want to talk about an initiative that we liked from Advance Auto Parts, much like we like the refreshed distribution initiatives from AutoZone that they talked so much about in their earnings call in the early part of this year. Now, we spoke about that market share mentality, or Leighton at least did, but perhaps the biggest avenue for growth is their dedicated mechanic business. Auto shops can sign up to be what they call a pro member, and they'd get access to beefed up customer service along with a ready inventory of over 500,000 parts that are primed to ship out. They rolled this out for e-commerce during the first quarter, and the leadership team, so far at least, seems thrilled with the results, despite the fact that all of the sales that we talked about dipped in those last 5 weeks of the quarter. Already, they have 20,000 members who have signed up. This is huge if they all remain even somewhat loyal to the program. Obviously, this was made up of some existing longtime Advanced Auto Parts customers, but they did mention acquiring new people altogether as a result of the program. They've made the Advanced Pro Catalog a little bit more user-friendly than their standard website, and the sales momentum so far has been well-received. They've integrated inventory across all their company divisions. Longtime listeners will remember the fact that they merged with CarQuest a while back, so Advanced, CarQuest, and WorldPack team members will all be able to see inventory in this one location. This reduces friction, and this reduction in friction is something that will continue to be looked at going forward. Less research time for these pro members is a key, at least the company thinks so. Everyone oftentimes in this industry is low on patience, so if they can find products quicker, it's not so much about getting them quicker, although you do want that, but if you can find products more quickly, then word-of-mouth impressions will start to take hold. And finally, the company wants to use even more data to be able to quickly adapt to change with regards to product assortment. They want to be able to better understand what it is that do-it-yourself customers need during a particular project and have that inventory on hand to meet that said need. According to internal company figures, they equate every 10 basis points more of upselling to $70 million more in sales. Quite a large figure. Now, investors may not have liked the revenue fall off, but they loved what executives had to say. Shares of Advance, ticker AAP, soared over 6% on Wednesday after the earnings release to $122 per share. This is still down from $140 per share where the stock was at this time last year. Again, this week's trading level represents a market cap just north of $9 billion. Positive for Advance. To sum it all up, they beat analysts' expectations. Sales still shrinking, but if they can execute particularly on this pro initiative, they may not be shrinking for too much longer.
Well, luckily for me, we have to close out the retail focus with one of my favorite retailers in Kohl's as they churn out yet another positive quarter. We recall back to 2016 when other analysts were already writing Kohl's' obituary, and here we have to see that 2016 looked more like a temporary blip on an otherwise clean radar for the department store. Shares had dipped all the way to $35 per share at the time, from all-time highs in 2015, not long before that, of $79 a share. They brought some of their best department store results in this earnings season, actually, and they showed no reason to doubt their direction moving forward. Kohl's noted same-store sales increases while they are shrinking their store footprint from some of their existing stores, which means sales per square foot should actually be going up. This will also give them the ability to unlock real estate value without having to forfeit sales or locations altogether. They have the added benefit of having a bigger presence in strip malls rather than indoor malls like JCPenney, for instance, where it proves difficult to split up those particular buildings and drive traffic. We look at the results now as those same-store sales did grow a robust 3.6% versus the 2.7% that was forecast by Thomson Reuters. The CFO said that the one likely culprit for the improved comps was Kohl's Friends and Family sales event for Mother's Day or before Mother's Day, and also helped to boost comparable sales versus the last year's marks. We see that higher ticket, neutral transaction was the story of their first quarter comps. Unlike with Advanced Auto Parts' leadership team, where there was an aura of positivity for the rest of the fiscal year, Kohl's did warn that these big events that are proving to be successful for these first and second quarters could hinder the top line performance for the third and fourth quarter. So potentially shareholders not liking those statements, but still though, their first quarter performance was simply one of the most solid within the department store sector, as this marked the third consecutive quarter for positive comps for the retailer. Sales hit a healthy $4.21 billion versus the expected $3.95 billion. This revenue beat showed year-over-year growth of around 3.5%, digital sales growth of 19%, so still within that 20% range that we've been seeing, and the buy online, pickup in-store has continued to expand, and they're seeing a lot of transaction growth there. This has helped maintain at least foot traffic at all of their stores as well. Even though we saw neutral foot traffic as far as the same store sales metrics were concerned, it still keeps customers coming into your store if they're fully utilizing the omni-channel there that they have in place. In the first quarter, Kohl's stores fulfilled approximately 30% of digital units compared to around 25% in the first quarter of last year. And lastly, Trent, earnings per share of 64 cents surpassed a consensus expectation of 50 cents per share. This adjusted earnings per share mark was indicative of a 65% increase year over year. And those GAAP earnings per share figures, they came in around 45 cents, taking into account a very large debt payoff that totaled around $500 million.
Now, as we've done with the other earnings calls, let's take a look at some of the insights we were able to glean from this week's call. Kohl's and their executive teams have been following through on the promise of several years ago to streamline their supply chain and clean up inventory woes. It seemed like every podcast we did about Kohl's in 2016 mentioned supply chain. And the idea here was to make sure that deep discounting and sales promotions no longer hurt gross margins as much as what they were. Now, this has paid off. And this has actually beat company expectations with how much more margin they were able to extract, as well as the timetable in which they did it. This was originally a 5-year plan, but they're really just about 2.5 years into it. They've now seen 9 straight quarters of inventory reduction. And what's neat is you wouldn't notice it by going into a store. Kohl's stores, well-stocked, full-looking, but the inventory that's gone, that's an inventory in the back that customers were never seeing until it got to a discount or a promotion. This quarter, they saw 50 basis points in gross margin improvement despite all of the promotions. Just like the Friends and Family event, for example, held on Mother's Day, gross margin was 36.9% this quarter, just for reference. Looking at the bottom line, there was also a benefit from lower shipping costs. Again, even though fuel costs are rising, we're seeing the segmented distribution channel that Kohl's has adopted pay off thanks to a heavy investment in IT infrastructure. With a little bit of capital expenditures and the large debt payoff, you'd expect less cash on the balance sheet. However, for Kohl's, liquidity is still relatively high as they have almost $200 million more in cash on the books right now versus this time in 2017. They also have lower lease and short-term financing obligations, and their expenses tied to the acquisition of property was also lesser. So overall, you add all of these things up, less interest expense, less lease and short-term financing obligations, and this makes for a more agile business. They still have 1,158 stores, which is neutral from where it was last year, although they closed some and added some during the last 4 quarters. Basically an even amount of stores. So unlike other department stores, they haven't had to close large swaths of stores in the last year to try and boost profitability. Real estate has been key for the retailer as they've significantly reduced their obligations. Partnering with Aldi and leasing some of their unused space looks to be paying off for them. And yet the partnership is still said to grow leaps and bounds from where it's currently at in the future. And honestly, that's one of those things that reduced inventory can do. If you reduce inventory, that allows you to cut down on the amount of storage space you have off the sales floor. It also enables you to cut down on the amount of square footage you're using to sell. If you can partner with Aldi or maybe another retailer to move into some of these locations, it can only be a good thing for Kohl's. And while we have no hard data to go off of, one can assume traffic to their stores will, of course, go up because of Aldi. Just as Aldi's traffic may benefit from a Kohl's being there, a lot of people make Aldi a constant trip. We'll talk about this actually during next week's interview, where we talk about how discount grocers are capturing more share of wallet in grocery. And even if it's just a few customers a day, this is a win-win for both Aldi and Kohl's, in our opinion, as the number of transactions at their stores have remained somewhat flat. Their stores, I mean Kohl's stores. Now, there was a downside, the only downside, Leighton, you think, from this earnings call.
As we see it, there was not a lot to not like for this particular quarter. And over the last 3 quarters, they've really been hitting on all cylinders with the Amazon partnership, teaming up with Aldi to try to relinquish some additional funds for their real estate. However, in terms of a growth story for Kohl's, investors may be seeing Kohl's as a company that has now hit full maturity. You see, with robust store count growth not really taking hold, management talked a lot about using funds to continue to reinvest in their current store base, talking about the continued expansion of omnichannel and really ironing out all of those things there that they put forth in terms of initiatives, and funneling additional cash in the future to stock buybacks, which they've already actually been doing to a great extent. So beyond finding more opportunities to squeeze out e-commerce sales, ironing out those omnichannel initiatives, and leasing chunks of their sales floor space, one could wonder, or maybe it would make sense to wonder at least, how this company can look back on itself in terms of future revenue prospects over the next 4 to 5 years. In 4 to 5 years, it would not surprise me to see only the most modest increases in top-line revenue for Kohl's, but perhaps a more robust bottom line as they create all of these efficiencies, and the earnings per share marks are going to be helped by those share buybacks. But still, that is a proper way of looking at this company because they haven't been increasing their store count. Yes, they are growing digital sales, but overall, maybe they have hit the peak in terms of what they can do in top line revenue. As we go back to the midterm, the company did raise guidance and now expects its adjusted fiscal 2018 diluted earnings per share to be between $5.05 a share to $5.50 per share. And this compares to previous guidance of $4.95 to $5.54, including this quarter's massive $500 million debt payment payoff. You see, earnings per share is more or less in line with prior guidance, which is great considering this wasn't originally part of their first forecast. Between the last 3 and 4 quarters, consistent stock buybacks, a stronger balance sheet, and long-term strategies taking hold, you'd think shares would have been fairly receptive on Tuesday after the SEC filing for earnings. Nope. Shares toppled over 7%, falling from around $65 a share to around $60 a share after earnings. They have since rebounded, or as of Wednesday at least, they came to around $62 a share at market close, giving the company around a 12 times price-to-earnings multiple at current revised full-year earnings estimates. So if you look at the company in that perspective and look at their dividend of around 4%, it's not a pricey company. But again, if you're a shareholder that's interested in fast growth, fast-paced capital gains, this is probably not going to be the company for you.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I talk about one thing we're keeping an eye on over the next week or the next month. And as we so often do, we begin with Leighton.
My looking ahead has to do with a story that broke late last week as BJ's Wholesale ended up filing for an IPO. So this is really going to shift the landscape for that particular company. But it's interesting because they were a publicly traded company not long ago. They were actually bought in around 2011 for $2.8 billion in cash and ticket private through equity firms Leonard & Greenham Partners and CVC Capital Partners. And overall, Trent, this is a company that you have to wonder, just like we were talking about with Kohl's, what is their opportunity for growth? I understand that Sam's Club just closed a little over 60 locations in the United States and that Costco has pretty much hit maturity. But in terms of outward expansion, in terms of growing the size or the amount of stores that you have in the United States, I just don't see it. However, it could be a sort of cashing out for those companies that took the company private not that long ago. So a very interesting article on CNBC goes through the details and the finances of the deal. I'm curious to see what their valuation is with regards to the current valuation of Costco. A lot to be looking forward to, and I'm excited as wholesale and the wholesale retail industry is something that I ended up growing up on.
And it's also interesting for us because now we get to finally look at their financials. We love it anytime a company goes public from private because it gives us a deeper look into the company's goings on. Well, it's earnings season, so it only is fitting that I'm looking ahead to an earnings call. And this earnings call next week will come from Dick's Sporting Goods that I'm looking forward to after Sportsman's Warehouse Holdings Incorporated reported this week. Dick's Sporting Goods is really one of the relative few businesses that we can look at in the sporting goods category to get an idea as to the relative health. Sporting goods retail has taken a big hit over the last couple of years, with the exception, perhaps, of wearables and athleisure, which everyone has been talking about. But Dick's in particular is bullish on the performance of the Reebok brand inside their stores. This is what I'm going to be looking at specifically. Can Dick's make a value proposition to their first quarter customer with this Reebok line? If not, might be a difficult year for Dick's, but I think that there could be a surprise, a positive one, in the offing. Now, Dick's has had issues with inventory and that type of thing getting the right inventory mix in the right areas of the country. So there are still a lot of things that Dick's has to work on, but it would not surprise me to see potentially a positive surprise next week, although, as I mentioned, it wouldn't surprise me to see a surprise going the other direction either. I'll be waiting and watching with bated breath, and we'll likely cover that very earnings call on this podcast a week from today. Well, once again, a thank you to you guys for listening. A thank you also to Inbal Levy, who joined us from WebPals to discuss the sales boost that happens around Ramadan and how businesses can target those surrounding Ramadan and the Ramadan holiday. We'll be back next week with an interview segment talking about the grocery industry and the state of the grocery industry from a data-driven perspective. Have a great week, everyone.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.